Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT evening format. Priority deadline to apply for September classes is August 5th. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Priska Neely in for A. Martinez. Happy Friday to you. Before we head out for the weekend, we've got some environmental news to get into. We'll talk about what the California Coastal Commission decided about off-roading in the Oceano Dunes during a long and heated debate yesterday. Plus, what happens now that the state's top oil regulator has been fired? Those stories are coming up in about 15 minutes, but we start today with State of Affairs. That's our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. This week, the fight over the 2020 census and the so-called citizenship question comes to an end. President Trump says his administration will pursue other options, but is the damage already done? Meanwhile, it's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi versus four freshman lawmakers known as the Squad. An internal power struggle goes public. We'll get into those stories and more with John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief for the LA Times. Welcome to you, John.
Hi. Hello.
Okay, so John, start us off. Governor Newsom, along with the governors of Washington and Oregon, penned an op-ed in the New York Times Thursday. It said President Trump's announcement that he'll get the citizenship information from other federal agencies instead of the census would not end anxiety in immigrant communities. How has the president's latest announcement been received in California?
I would say it's a combination of relief. I think there's a number of elected officials in California who are worried about that attempt, both what it might mean for California and just the sense of fear and concern among immigrants in California about the uncertainty of answering the census. And I also think it's created an extra dose of defiance, that it was the wrong approach all to begin with. The governor has said that. The attorney general, Javier Becerra, has said that in the last couple of days. They think they were right all along. They think this proves it.
And we'll talk about this more. I want to bring in now Zach Corser. He co-directs the policy lab at Claremont McKenna College. Hey, Zach.
Hi, glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. Want to get your look at the census and the citizenship question. Jessica Levinson at Loyola Law School told Politico that yesterday's announcement can still be seen as a political win for the president's base. What's your take on that, Zach? Is it a win?
Well, I think of a sort. There's sort of two stories going on right now. One is a longer-term story about a Republican strategy to improve their numbers in redistricting and restrict numbers in states like California that have a large immigrant population. On that sort of legal strategy, I mean, that was clearly lost a couple weeks ago when the Commerce Department and the Justice Department basically threw up their hands. When Justice Roberts says, look, your reasons that you're providing are frankly contrived, that's the word mm-hmm. he used, and that you're going to have to send this back to the courts. And they were up against a printing deadline. I mean, sometimes, you know, these deadlines just happen. You have to get these out. So Trump did not like that answer. I think it looked like it was a defeat for the administration, which it was. This legal strategy, this administrative strategy has failed, and Trump always wants to walk away looking like a strong man and looking like a winner. And so I think this executive order, it's a lot of bluster. It's something that was going to happen anyway, but it's Trump trying to look like he's still strong on immigration and that, you know, this fight is continuing and on his terms. But I think, frankly, it was actually a big defeat.
Yeah. Now, John, as long as this stays in the zeitgeist, and as the governors noted, there could still be fear in immigrant communities, maybe even a hesitancy to participate. Remind us what's at stake for California with the census.
Yeah, there's a lot at stake. I mean, certainly Zach pointed out part of it is political in the way that congressional districts are drawn, representation and who those would be. But there are an enormous amount of federal dollars that are attached to population numbers. Especially in social services programs, those for the most needy. A lower population in California if you either did not count people without legal status or you scared away people who have legal status who just then were frightened of giving information, that would severely impact the amount of money that comes into the state, which also could throw a lot of the responsibility back to the state government and trying to balance the state budget that way. So I'd say the stakes are quite large, and I think that there already has been a sense of fear in immigrant communities, especially like if you look at households where maybe most of the people are here of legal status and one is not or a relative is not, the whole household could just say, I don't want to take the census. And that could be damaging. So you've had California officials saying they've got to do a big PR campaign as it is. And I think they are going to want to redouble those efforts, even in the wake of what happened, to say, look, this information is secure. Please answer the census.
Yeah, we've been talking about the census and its importance a lot, and we'll keep watching the story as it unfolds. But moving on, John, Democratic infighting in the House has come out into the open this week, and at the center of it is Speaker Nancy Pelosi. What's the story here?
This is a fascinating one. I mean, and it's interesting, you know, I cover state government in Sacramento, but you could see the same kind of thing someday happening here as is happening in Washington. Nancy Pelosi clearly talking to her fellow Democrats this week and saying, don't speak poorly of other Democrats in public. Don't take to Twitter and tweet about them. You know, basically pointing out the most progressive members who were elected in this last election, folks like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York and others, saying, don't criticize moderate or centrist Democrats in public. You know, have your issues solved here. It's almost the modern day version of Ronald Reagan's old 11th commandment, don't speak ill of fellow Republicans, except on the Democratic side. And Pelosi is a master legislator. She has kept her caucus together, but this is a different caucus. They answer to a different set of social realities and social media, and it's pretty fascinating to watch her trying to keep everybody in line here as they move toward the 2020 election.
Yeah, very, very different rules, a different world. Zach, there's a clear gap here between Nancy Pelosi, who has led House Dems for more than 16 years, and the political newcomers. You know, they both wield a certain kind of power. But in a power struggle like the one that we've seen play out, you know, does a Twitter following really help the freshman here?
Well, it's a power base for sure. Nancy Pelosi had a great quote at that meeting, I thought, where she said that, not singling out anyone in particular, but obviously implying, you know, she's talking to the squad, as they're becoming known, the most progressive members of the Democratic caucus, where she says, you know, a lot of you are engaged in creating a beautiful pate, but we're making sausage here most of the time. And I thought that was a great analogy and sort of demonstrates that Nancy Pelosi is an institutionalist. She knows how Congress works. And, you know, she has a plan and a strategy about getting legislation through this sausage-making process. And I think it's a different set of values maybe we could say an older way of thinking about Congress that is not immediate, that doesn't communicate through Twitter very well, that takes account of a bewildering number of interests in order to accomplish legislation. And so her motivations and her experience put her in a very different orientation than, you know, these progressive Democrats. And so, you know, this sort of immediacy, this demand for ideological purity, this sort of, you know, black and white, and if you disagree with me, then you're not somehow genuine or right. You know, I think Pelosi was particularly annoyed at the suggestion that moderate Democrats would be called the Child Abusers Caucus for having supported this bill that was ultimately a compromise relating to what's happening on the border right now. And so she's trying to bring peace, but she doesn't have too many levers of power. And I guess that gets back to your initial question. You know, AOC and others, you know, they've got their own base, so to speak, that they talk to through Twitter. They've got their own fundraising sources. And so, I mean, other than, like, you know, taking away committee assignments or trying to cut off party monies, there's really not a lot the speaker can do right now.
Yeah. This is State of Affairs, our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State, and I am with Claremont McKenna's Zach Corser and John Myers of the LA Times. John, how would you personally describe this chapter in politics? Because we've got Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez telling the Washington Post that Pelosi is singling out newly elected women of color, and one of her top aides even called moderate Democrats new Southern Democrats. What do you make of all this?
You know, it's hard to give it a name. I mean, it's a divisive era, certainly. There's a generational element to this, I think. There's also just kind of a practical, philosophical, operational difference here. There is a universe of Nancy Pelosi's era in politics about pragmatism, governing. That's not to say that she's not liberal. She obviously is, but looking for a way to govern. And some of these other members, it's not that they don't want to govern, but they don't believe in compromising particular issues, and they would rather, they'd rather stay true to those issues. We're seeing it in the presidential campaign. We are seeing it in Sacramento, where I sit here. This is a period where Californians and Americans are sharply divided about what it means. Do you want to be pragmatic and govern and try to find common ground, or do you want to stick to your ground and stick to your guns? And I think we're seeing it play out writ large here in this debate in Washington.
Okay, moving on to some other issues here in California. Governor Newsom has had a really busy week championing a bill that would overhaul how the state pays for wildfire damage caused by major utilities. And he's now signed that bill. John, really briefly, what's in that bill?
Yeah, signed it just a few hours ago here in Sacramento. In short, this is a bill to create a pot of money, a pot of cash that utility companies could go to in the event they are involved, their equipment's involved in wildfires. Part of it would come from ratepayers with a small fee that would continue to exist on some ratepayers' bills. These are people who are customers of PG&E, Southern California Edison, San Diego Gas and Electric. And then those big companies would put their own money into a pot as well, and it could total some $20 billion by the time it's all over. The real question here, though, I think, is that helps the utilities pay their wildfire bills, but it still doesn't get to the issue of wildfire prevention in a lot of communities. I think we're going to hear a lot more about that this summer.
Right. And Zach, you know, lawmakers were up against a deadline here. Today is the last day before summer recess. And credit agencies also had the threat, you know, were threatened to downgrade the state's top utilities. What have critics said about this bill? And, you know, is the criticism warranted in your view?
Well, I think the sausage-making analogy is useful here, where, again, the state's running up against a deadline. There's already concerns about downgrading other utilities around the state, like Southern California Edison. There was a wildfire in its area that has prompted a downgrade. And so, you know, the state and then Governor Newsom and I think the legislature came together very quickly to try to put together what they thought was a sort of workable stopgap to make sure that a larger financial disaster of lowering credit ratings and increasing the expense of borrowing for California utilities, that didn't happen. So I think this has to be considered sort of a first and important step. But, yeah, there's still more to be done, and I think that's probably the best way to look at this.
Yeah. So, John, the signing of this bill comes on the heels of a Wall Street Journal investigation that revealed, you know, the utility PG&E knew its power lines needed to be replaced and could start fires long before last year's fire in Paradise. And a judge has now ordered the company to respond to that. But this really seems like it's the start of a broader conversation about how to handle utilities, you know, in the state. Are they too big to fail? What might lawmakers focus on when they return from summer recess, just really quickly here?
I mean, I think they're going to go back again to look at how to deal with wildfire prevention. But I will tell you, we have spent two or three summers up here in Sacramento debating wildfire prevention issues. And it's not easy because it deals with where you build these homes, how you harden these homes, what the role of the insurance industry is in making sure that they continue to issue insurance policies in these areas. It's a really complicated topic. And I will tell you, every summer that we've talked about it, we see fire clouds of smoke from fires in Northern California around the Capitol. Capitol. As a reminder, this is a serious season. It's a serious topic. There are no easy answers. I think it's going to be really hard to find a comprehensive plan to all of this before they adjourn for the year.
Yeah, and it's heating up, so I'm sure we're going to be talking about wildfire season really soon here. John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief for the LA Times. Zach Corser co-directs the Policy Lab at Claremont McKenna College. Thanks so much to both of you for making the time.
Have a great weekend.
You're welcome.
Coming up, we've got a couple more environmental stories for you. The state's top oil regulator was fired last night. We'll talk about why the governor's so fired up about that and why the Oceano Dunes near Pismo Beach are at the center of a land use fight. Stay with us here on Take Two. You're back with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Prisca Neely in for A. Martinez. The state's top oil regulator was fired last night. Ken Harris was the head of the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources, also known as Dogger. And this came barely a day after an article in the Desert Sun reported an increase in the number of fracking permits given out to energy companies. In addition, several watchdog groups sent a letter to Governor Gavin Newsom highlighting conflicts of interest among those working for the agency. And now an investigation is underway. Janet Wilson is an environmental reporter for the Desert Sun and has been following all this. Hi, Janet.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Thank you for being here. So the governor was pretty swift in his order to fire Ken Harris. Do we know specifically what Harris did?
So Harris oversaw the entire department charged with regulating the oil and gas industry in California. That he did not invest himself in the oil companies, but seven of his senior supervisors do have investments in BP, Chevron, Exxon, a lot of other big companies. He also, his name is the signature on all of the fracking and oil drilling permits in the state.
So groups like Consumer Watchdog found these conflicts of interest among Dogger employees. Tell me more about what they discovered.
So senior supervisors at all agencies across the state are required to file Form 700s, their disclosure forms about investments and potential conflicts of interest. And seven of them, as I mentioned, did report that they have investments in companies that do business and sell and refine oil and gas in the state of California. And then an eighth supervisor actually has a side consulting business in this area.
Now, how many permits had Harris signed off on so far this year, and how many were granted compared with last year?
Fracking permits,
yes.
I found, had doubled.
Wow.
Since Newsom took office. Yes, there were 211 permits issued in the first 6 months of this year. And for all of 2018, there were 223 permits. So pretty much double. And this is quite a surprise because Governor Brown was considered much more friendly to the oil industry than Governor Newsom, who didn't take any donations from oil companies. He took a pledge not to take any donations from the oil companies, and he didn't during the campaign. So, yeah, it's quite a surprise.
Yeah, that is a big increase and a lot of fracking. Remind us how that process works and where it's happening in California.
So fracking is when the oil deposits start to get exhausted in the fields and they want to get the last bits out. And so the energy companies blast steam down into boreholes to fracture rocks that hold the remnant crude oil and push it up. And it has been linked to groundwater contamination, increased earthquakes, air pollution, and other public health issues.
Now, the governor today told reporters he was very angry about what happened at Dogger, and he responded very quickly by firing Harris. What does this signal to you about Newsom's position on drilling in the state and what action he may take on fracking going forward?
Well, I think he truly, according to his chief of staff, he had no idea that fracking and other oil permits had increased so sharply. And so I think he wanted to distance himself and to signal that this agency that's often been riven by conflict in the past, there are going to be changes under his watch.
Yeah, because this process is happening really all over a lot in a lot of areas in L.A., too, right? When we talk about what's happening locally, like this is something that's happening in L.A.
Yes, not just fracking, but also oil drilling, which is way up also. More than 2,000 permits and 45% of those permits, these watchdog groups found, have been issued to companies in which these senior officials hold investments. So fracking is just one piece of it.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, despite California's outsized global environmental reputation, we also have a 104-year history of a lot of oil and gas drilling, which we all use every day in our cars and a lot of other products. So in the Central Coast area, in Los Angeles, in Long Beach, you will see these pump jacks right next to schoolyards and homes and playgrounds. And so opponents really, really would like to see a 2,500-foot buffer put in place between these operations and ordinary people.
Now, Janet, just really quickly here, this investigation has started into the conflict of interest issue. What can we expect?
I think we can continue to expect pretty swift action and maybe some changes in some policies, too, because they did say in the letter they sent that they are possibly going to be reformulating some conflict of interest policies as well.
Great. That's Janet Wilson of the Desert Sun talking to us about her reporting on the shakeup at the state's Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources. Thanks so much, Janet.
Thank you.
Now to another environmental story with a recreational twist. The Oceano Dunes has long been the subject of a heated debate over land use rights. The sand dune near Pismo Beach is a popular area among off-road vehicle enthusiasts who were protesting a proposed plan to restrict their access to the dunes' 1,500 acres. Now on the other side of the debate are environmentalists who say all the vehicles do nothing but generate noise and air pollution, and they also infringe upon endangered species. So yesterday, the California Coastal Commission took up the issue, hearing 6 long hours of public testimony to decide if off-roading should be restricted in the only state park that allows vehicles on its beaches and dunes. Tony Barboza has been following all this for the LA Times and joins us now. Tony, welcome back to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
Now, yesterday's California Coastal Commission hearing was long and contentious. But before we get to what was decided, tell us what restrictions were being considered for Oceano Dunes and why.
Now, the State Coastal Commission came out with a recommendation a few weeks ago last month and said basically after decades of allowing vehicles to use this property under an interim or temporary permit, we finally need to do something to address their impacts. So they were suggesting, the staff of the Coastal Commission was suggesting to its board of appointees that they impose some near-term restrictions on the number of vehicles and other measures to protect endangered species and protect air quality. And notably, they said that eventually, over time, that vehicle use should be phased out, should be eliminated from the park.
So after all of this back and forth yesterday, this, you know, 6-hour-long meeting between off-roaders and environmentalists, what happened?
So basically, what happened was the Coastal Commission rejected its staff's recommendation and decided to give the State Parks Department, which operates the property, another year to come up with its own plan. So it was a very heated proceeding with often very emotional testimony about off-roading enthusiasts who have been using the land for generations, and also from environmentalists and community members who spoke of degraded air quality and not being able to access the beach for more traditional uses like sunbathing or even just walking on the beach.
So the Coastal Commission had previously recommended restricting off-road vehicles access to the dunes. So why did it reverse its own recommendation?
Now, the panel, the actual commission, rejected its staff's recommendations,
okay,
and they always have the authority to do that.
Mm-hmm.
What was notable about it is, it wasn't a very clear-cut issue where you had the same commissioners saying that, you know, this, we recognize that these are serious issues, that endangered birds getting killed under vehicle tires is a serious problem. Some of them referred to it as an environmental disaster, but they also wanted to kind of respect the process and give the State Parks Department time to see if it can manage these issues on its own.
So as you mentioned, they do have a year to come up with a plan where conservation and recreation can kind of figure out how to coexist. Real quickly, do you think that could happen?
It's hard to see that, at least based on the proceeding that unfolded yesterday. You really had two sharply divided camps. Off-road riders who were really digging in their heels and said that we've already lost a lot of riding area to, you know, you've got areas of the vast areas of this these dunes that are already blocked off for dust suppression and endangered species protection. And then on the other side, you had community members saying that this just shouldn't be allowed, that things change over time and that what we tolerated decades ago shouldn't continue. So it's possible, but it's kind of leaves unresolved the issue. And I guess we'll see in the coming months and in the year, next year, if there is a way to resolve this.
Well, I'm sure you'll be watching and we'll talk to you again. Tony Barboza is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He's been speaking with us about the California Coastal Commission's decision to continue to allow off-road vehicles at Oceano Dunes. Thanks so much for your time, Tony.
Thank you.
Now a look at learning. School's been out for a little while now, ushering in that time of year when academics start worrying about the summer slide. That's when children can lose some of the academic gains they made in the previous year. This transition can be especially tricky for preschoolers who are heading into kindergarten with bigger class sizes, maybe a longer school day with less time for play. But there's a lot parents and caregivers can do to ease that transition. And we've got some tips for you about how to make the most out of summer. Jennifer Ramirez is a child development consultant with the Los Angeles County Office of Education.
One of the big takeaways for me is always strive for 20.
That's 20 minutes of reading every day. And it doesn't have to be a structured story time. It doesn't have to be all at once. But reading and discussion will help them to soak up more words and start thinking critically.
And just ask them different questions and discuss new words that you learned in the book. Who was your favorite character? Does this remind you of any other book that you've ever read?
Tip 2, get out of the house. Explore the resources in your community to keep children stimulated.
If it's a museum, your parks, your public libraries, using the outdoor spaces, whether it's the beach, the mountains, going for a hike.
Now, parents, we realize that you may not be on summer break, and it could be hard to schedule all of this into your days. Ramirez is a working mom, and she gets that. That's where tip 3 comes in. You can turn everyday moments into learning opportunities.
Doing chores even at home, if you have your very young child help you sort socks and make pairs, that's, you know, sorting and classifying, which is a very important mathematical concept.
Putting in this work and getting the transition from pre-K to kindergarten right can have long-term benefits as children enter higher grades. So hear that, parents. Being engaged is a big part of your kid's success in school. So keep it up when the school year starts. And if you're looking for some recommendations for how to keep your children stimulated this summer, we have got a good one for you. The Caton Children's Museum in Santa Monica, we got a tour and we'll have a look inside coming up next.
Bye.
podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, an online hybrid tailored for working professionals with attendance only twice per term in West LA. Attend an info session to learn more. Classes start September 3rd. Apply by August 5th for up to $8,000 in scholarships at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Close your eyes, and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Remember,
with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Priska Neely in for A. Martinez. If you're looking for some suggestions to keep the children in your life engaged this summer, we've got a recommendation. The new Caton Children's Museum in downtown Santa Monica. It opened at the end of June, so we went to check it out this week. What you're hearing is the sound of children leaping and diving into a ball pit. Filled with blue and gray balls to represent the ocean, the pit has a Coast Guard rescue boat at its center. Like each of the 35 immersive exhibits at the Caton Children's Museum, this one has a lesson. And to share those lessons, we had a special tour guide.
I'm Esther Netter. I'm the CEO and founder of the Caton Children's Museum. We are standing inside our just opened to the public new museum here at Santa Monica Place.
As we walked around the 21,000 square feet of the sprawling complex, exploring the exhibits, I asked Netter if she has a favorite.
It's like asking a mama to pick her favorite child. This has been a long journey working with an incredible team to make this all happen. You know what? I don't have a particular favorite when I'm here with my grandchildren. It's probably the Coast Guard rescue boat and our vintage fire truck.
Well, we're standing right in front of the Coast Guard exhibit and this fire truck. So tell us about this area.
So this exhibit here is called Let's Help. So the museum itself has five core exhibit wings. Each of them are meant to be really the stage or the runway for kids to practice different aspects of who they are, so aspects of their character and traits. So Let's Help is about giving our visitors the chance to practice rescue. And so this is kind of rescue play. And really paying homage to first responders and people who are in community and who are our helpers.
I cover early childhood for KPCC, so I'm telling stories about babies, toddlers, and preschoolers. And I know this museum is catering to ages 0 to 10, but there are spaces specifically for the little ones, for your youngest visitors. So this is one of those areas, the Skyscape area. So tell us what we're seeing here for the little ones.
So this exhibit wing is called Launch Your. It is for our youngest visitors, 0 to 2, and the grown-ups that come with them. We wanted to create an area that was separate, protected, but also a place that was big enough for our littlest visitors to kind of roam and direct their play and their adventure, with benches both on the inside and outside, understanding that there will be families that need to straddle, literally and metaphorically, this exhibit area, watching bigger kids in different exhibits and their youngest ones here at Launch Your. You know from the work that you are doing that families with young children are always looking for a space where you can let go, meaning let your child kind of be,
right,
and manage their own movement and changes of placement. And we wanted to create a big space for that for our families who come and visit.
You know, so much of early childhood education, when we're talking about the little ones, is really about just exploration and play. And, you know, everything is learning at that point. So that really seems like that's the goal of this.
100%. I would even jump on that pearl of wisdom and say that all kids learn through play. And I think that it's an aspect of learning and responding to one's own curiosity to give up that notion of play. So as much as this space has been designed for kids 0 to 10 and the grown-ups that come with them, I'm hoping that crossing the threshold into the Caton Children's Museum will spark something in the inner child in each of us.
I think when we think about field trips and taking children out in any way, you always wonder about rules or if there's anything that you need to practice at home. Are there any rules here?
I would say that there are, it's a museum that's built on hope, aspiration, and giving our youngest visitors the leeway to lead the play, make their own discoveries. But part of doing that in community is that what everybody here has in common is that we all show up with at least one child. Other than that, we are each unique and each kind of represent our own story.
But it sounds like maybe one overarching rule could just be a good human.
That's my line. Be a good human. So that's what we're about. So that this is a place to practice being the best version of yourself.
So since we've been talking a lot about cooperation, sounds like we should check out the Together We wing, which is
okay.
All about that.
That's being painted for that back wall. Here
these are
our,
such adorable shopping carts.
Isn't this the cutest thing?
Yeah.
So this is like...
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So even all, this space, by the way, when you mentioned about this being a place to practice being human. So part of the context is also to create the backdrop of real life. So the market and the machine that you can scan things, the cafe and the kitchen, that a chance for our youngest visitors to practice being grown up is to model and mimic and try on these different roles that they see around them.
Wow. So we've got, I'm just going to kind of describe some
yeah.
of what we're seeing here. We've got, you know, little loaves of bread, peppers, bananas, carrots.
Part of what we've also built in is Habits for Health. Habits for Health is an initiative that has us looking at each of our exhibits, nutrition, hydration, the importance of rest and play and connection and sleep and exercise.
My name is Morgan, and we're from San Diego. Oliver is 10 years old. What is your favorite part of this museum?
My favorite part would probably be the shopping. I like the motion sensor for the scanning, and I also like shopping and seeing my prices. Because once I got a $999,994 discount.
Ooh.
So this space, it should also sound like we're camping in the mountains.
It does. It feels like it.
We wanted to create a calm, darker, quiet space for our visitors to practice being still enough to notice what's going on around us and being quiet enough to really listen. So in this space, there are two projections.
So we're on the nightscape now, and there's a moon in the sky, rolling hills, twinkling stars, and fireflies or lightning bugs, depending on where you're from.
They only fill this space when the space is quiet.
Wow.
And when there isn't movement going around. In tune with nature, it's about not doing anything. That's this space.
This is lovely. I feel like you can meditate in here. So you founded the Zimmer Children's Museum, another space about a quarter of this size, back in 1990. Has anything changed about the mission as you see it of children's museums in that time?
I think children's museums over the last 30 years have just continued to build on their role, serving as a central gathering place for families, as a place to bring families from all different communities and backgrounds, tourists and locals, to bring them together for an experience of this shared play and discovery.
So in the days that you've been open so far, what kind of response have you gotten from the adults who've come? You know, are they rediscovering their inner child?
Adults get really playful really quickly. The ideas that we hope this children's museum is reminiscent of other children's museums that any one of us may have been to in the course of our growing up. This is a space that grants all of our visitors permission to be playful. So you do see adults putting on costumes, being engaged in theatrical role play with their children or even with others' children. And we get a lot of questions from adults about whether they can have birthday parties here. But yes, this definitely is a place that celebrates the child inside each of us.
Well, Esther Netter, CEO of the Caton Children's Museum, thanks so much for showing us around and letting us spend time here today.
Thank you so much. We hope that you come back and join us in playing our way to a better world. Thanks so much.
And there's a lot more Take Two coming up, so stick with us.
Let's play, come on this jazzy Django day, let's play. Oh yeah, rain or shine, we'll have some fun. Let's play, hey, hey, on this razzle-dazzle day. Yap, bop, bop, doo-da-da, boom, bop, beedle.
Back now with Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Priska Neely, in for A. Martinez. Did you feel any shaking this morning? I know I did. Around 6:15 or so, a 4.9 magnitude earthquake rattled through Ridgecrest, about 150 miles away. This comes just 1 week after two much more powerful quakes hit the area in the Mojave Desert. Now, earthquakes are a reality of living in Southern California, and officials are thinking more and more about how to prepare for the big one, including leaders in the LA Unified School District. Eagle Rock High is the first public school in California to implement an earthquake warning system. For more on this hardwired system in LA Unified's disaster plan, we're turning to Jill Barnes. She's the executive emergency strategist at LAUSD. Welcome to Take Two.
Thanks for having me.
Can you describe how exactly this system is meant to work in schools? You know, if I were a student sitting in class, what would I experience?
So at the school site, we've put it in through the PA system. And through the PA system, it will, a little recorded announcement and a tone will go out to through every speaker at that school. And then it says, earthquake expected, drop cover and hold on.
This technology is designed by Early Warning Labs in partnership with the U.S. Geological Survey. And it's different from LA's Shake Alert app, which we talked about on the show earlier this week. So how exactly does it work?
So there are two waves in an earthquake, and we feel the second wave. That's where we actually experience the shaking. But the first wave, all of those USGS sensors are picking up the data from that first wave, and then they send it out to all of the different early warning systems, including the one that goes through our PA system. So everybody's using the same sensors. We're all using that data and the sensors. It's the delivery method that's different. And it's one of those things that has to happen really, really fast, because if the system isn't fast enough, then the earthquake is here and we're experiencing shaking without getting that early warning.
So this is a pilot program within the school district. How long has it been in the works, to get this rolled out?
We actually installed an earlier version on desktop computers at Eagle Rock High School in October of 2015 as part of our shakeout experience for that month. The desktop version functioned the same way, but instead of going through the PA system, the alert tone just came over the speakers through the computers in those classrooms. But we needed to start with that. For one thing, that's what was available then, and it gave us an opportunity to be able to test how that would work and how people would really react before putting it in a school-wide system.
And how much does all of this cost? You know, how can we afford to roll it out? Are we looking to do this in other schools?
We're definitely looking at implementing it in other schools. We do have two more devices that are provided as part of this agreement, so we will be selecting two more schools to put those in. It's preliminary at this point. We're just beginning to explore what it would take to roll it out to more schools and exploring all the options that we have available to us. It's so new that there really aren't established costs in the field for it.
So we're talking about warning, you know, in the moments before an earthquake hits. But what else is being done to make sure that school buildings are safe and secure?
So one cool thing is that California has the FEALD Act, which is a law that states that public school buildings that are built with public funds, which is all of the LAUSD schools, are built to a higher construction standard, so they're more resistant to an earthquake. I actually heard Lucy Jones say once that she would rather be in a California public school building during an earthquake than any other building in the state, and she did tell me I could quote her.
Wow.
So they're actually less, our school buildings are actually less likely to be damaged from an earthquake than many of the other surrounding buildings.
Okay, now two more schools are set to receive the system in coming months. Is this the future for LA Unified schools when it comes to disaster preparedness?
I believe that it is. It doesn't change what we do because we still drop, cover, and hold on, but it gives us extra time to do it. So it's very important for students with physical disabilities. If a student uses a wheelchair, it gives somebody time to wheel that student into a protected area of the classroom and lock the wheels on the wheelchair and for that assistant to get themselves protected before the shaking starts. It's great for young students. We have primary students. We have preschoolers, we even have a few infant programs, so it actually allows us to take protective actions ahead of time with those kids. Specialized settings like science labs, we have a chance to turn off the Bunsen burner, get the pots off of the stoves if someone's cooking something before the shaking starts.
Jill Barnes is the Executive Emergency Strategist at the Los Angeles Unified School District. Thanks so much for taking the time today. Great to talk to you.
My pleasure.
Finally, let's wrap up today's show with some of the best events to check out this weekend.
I'm Christine Ziemba from LAist.
And I'm KPCC's Leo Durand. If your weekend's looking deserted, there are many things happening that can fill it up.
Long before Westworld or binge-worthy TV, there was a matinee serial in the 30s called The Phantom Empire that combines sci-fi, westerns, and even musicals. Now, the plot involves evil scientists, the underground empire of Morania, robots, ray guns, and singing cowboy Gene Autry. So the Autry Museum is showing all 12 episodes Saturday morning starting at 10:30 as part of its Weird West film series. The film is included with museum admission, which runs $6 to $14.
Then, like Westworld, let's go from the Wild West to pure sci-fi for another museum event. Now, they're still building the Lucas Museum in Expo Park. That's the one George Lucas is behind. But, as a preview, the staff is hosting a public event in Leimert Park tomorrow. It features a Star Wars concept artist, a makeup artist, and others talking about what inspires their work and how you can get inspired too. Plus, you can make your own creature masks and take pictures. There will be free shuttles around the neighborhood to bring you to and from the event, and this is free.
The Venice Art Crawl and the Mar Vista Music and Art Walk have teamed up for an event tomorrow that stretches along 3.5 miles of Venice Boulevard from 405 to the beach. They're calling it the Get Around, and they say it's going to be one of the largest arts festivals the West Side has ever seen. With a theme of music, art, and mobility, the festival offers dozens of activities and showcases micro-mobility alternatives like dockless scooters, smart bikes, and hoverboards. And if you don't feel like walking to the Get Around, free shuttle buses will run between several key hubs during the entire event. The festival runs from 2 to 10 p.m. on Saturday.
Finally, it is supposed to be a hot one this weekend, so here's one for adults to cool off. Today and tomorrow is the 6th annual OC Brew Hee Haw Craft Beer Roundup. That is a mouthful. It happens at the hangar at the OC Fair. There will be 80 choices to sample from, and speaking of the 80s, there's going to be an 80s tribute band like Dead Man's Party, also another one called Fast Times. And when you go, you've got this four-hour window for all you can taste. Yeah, that's right. Plus, it comes with entry to the OC Fair. And passes start at $55. Now, there's so much more to do this weekend. You can check out our full list of events on LAIST.com. That is LAIST.com.
I'm Christine Ziemba from LAIST.
And I'm KPCC's Leo Durand.
Have a good weekend, all.
Hope
you got some good ideas to make the most of this weekend and to stay cool. That is it for Take Two today. Thank you so much for trusting us with your time. It was great to be here with you this week, filling in for A. Martinez. If you missed any part of the show, you can listen wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter at Take Two. I'm Prisca Neely, and you can follow me on Twitter at Prisca Neely. I'll be back here with you on Monday. Have a great weekend and stay cool, everybody.